Okay, so back when it used to rain in California, I'm driving down the 580 Interstate Freeway, going to the grocery store, wife, little boy, little girl, myself. Then, no notice, a rainbow blazes in front of us, intense. And I don't mean in front of us up in the sky where it's supposed to be. I mean right in front of us, right there in front of us. We're driving, and then the air shimmers, golden, for 3, maybe 5 seconds, and then there's no more rainbow. My little girl shouts, "There it is!" And I see it in the rearview mirror. We had just driven through a rainbow. And I'm upset, furious. Number one, I didn't think that was supposed to be possible. My science teachers all lied to me, but really, I'm angry because I always wanted to get to the end of the rainbow, and I finally do, and it's in the middle of the interstate highway. No leprechauns, no pot of gold. I feel robbed until I check the back seat and see their little faces, radiant, beaming, delighted, still touched with magic. Today on Snap Judgment, we proudly present The End of the Rainbow. Stories from real people finding a different version of what they're looking for. My name is Glenn Washington. Now, I just want to catch Bigfoot. Because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now, for our first story, we delve into the deep abyss. Think Alice in Wonderland, falling down a dark tunnel and getting stuck.
One day in the middle of an England summer, Anna Lindsay stood in a small room on the second floor of her house. It had a single bed, a dresser, and one window with sunshine streaming in.
I could see outside. I could see this beautiful summer, the summer of 2006, and I was gradually covering it up and thinking, I wonder if I'll ever see that again. I'd already got some blackout curtain linings. I got a blackout ruler blind, fitted it in the alcove of the window. So I put the blind down, I shut the curtains. But that wasn't blackout, unfortunately, because light still gets in around the edges. So I got large rolls of kitchen foil and I stuck them to the window panes with pieces of tape. I put the ruler blind down, I closed the curtains, and then I sat down the bed and waited, let my eyes adjust, and then finally I had it. It was completely pitch black. If I held my hand out in front of my face, I couldn't see it. And I remember feeling the relief as the pain ebbed away. I just collapsed on the bed. I've done this, but God, what a terrible thing to have to do. It felt like I'd amputated the light from my life.
It all started the year before, as Anna was sitting in front of her computer screen at work.
I'd start to feel this sort of prickling and tingling in my skin.
Then it happened under fluorescent lights.
It would gradually start to build, and I'd start to get hotter and hotter.
And then, in the sunlight,
it felt like somebody was holding a blowtorch in front of my face.
The burning then spread to other parts of her body. She had an extreme case of light sensitivity.
Light and computer exacerbated photosensitive seborrheic dermatitis, which is a bit of a mouthful.
And when she talked to her doctor,
although he'd seen similar cases before, he didn't have a solution to suggest. So I was left experimenting.
She applied creams. She used washes. She wore layers of UV protective clothing.
This burning just got worse and worse. Something's happening to me, which I completely don't understand, and I can't control it. I'd lost my job, I'd lost my career. I thought my life was falling apart.
So now here she was, seeking refuge in the black, hoping that once her skin calms down and gains some resilience,
I could find a way back somehow. The first few days in the dark, it was very, very disorientating. My brain and my senses disconnected. Nothing was where I thought it was. I'd sit there thinking that I was facing in a particular direction, and then I'd move to get up and find that I'd crashed into the bookcase. And this was really, really terrifying. I panicked. And I just kind of lie on the floor, because on the floor I felt safe. So then I just have to lie there and very, very slowly reach my hand out, feel around, and then gradually rebuild this picture of where I must be in the room.
The first thing Anna did was reach for the small radio that was sitting on a nearby shelf.
I turned from Radio 4 to Radio 2, and it was playing some really banal pop song. I'm afraid I can't remember what it was, but it wasn't one I knew, and it wasn't one I particularly liked. And I only listened to kind of a few seconds of it. It would reduce me to tears. It just short-circuited my brain, and I just became really, really unhappy and distressed and kind of thought about the past and thought about what I'd lost. Okay, my radio stays on talk radio. I don't turn it this way. I don't turn the knob that way. When I came out the room, I would start to feel just sort of the beginnings of something happening in my skin. I would sort of get myself a cup of tea, get myself something to eat it very quickly, and the clock was ticking. I'd have to go back upstairs and go back into the darkness again to get my skin to calm down. I'd sit there in my dark room like a kind of enchanted princess. Sometimes I sat on the floor with my back to the bed. Sometimes I lay down on the floor. Sometimes I lay on the bed. Sometimes I sat on the bed. And sometimes I'd sort of stand up in the middle of the room and march up and down on the spot. I'd wake up very early in the morning and I'd hear the dawn chorus, all this kind of fluting and twittering of birds. I heard the voices of the neighbours chatting to each other, and I heard the voices of the children in the street as well. I think it was even more tantalising because I couldn't hear what they were saying exactly. Oh, it gave me such yearning, it really did. And I'd also hear people shutting the car doors and going to work at particular times of the morning or coming back from work. I used to do that. I used to go to work and I wasn't anymore. I felt utterly useless and utterly impotent in the world and had no ability to have an effect on it at all. I was imprisoned in these four walls and I had been reduced to just a pair of ears.
To pass the time and ground herself in something, Anna devoured audiobooks.
And it got to the point that if I got to the end of one CD or one tape, even in that little gap where the book stopped, I would start to feel my despair coming back and I would move on as fast as I could in the dark to kind of get the next CD in and press a button and get it started again so that my reality was blocked out as quickly as possible and I was back in the book. As I've spent longer and longer in the dark, not being able to see any part of my body, it's almost like I started to believe I didn't exist anymore. I was just some kind of disembodied spirit, some kind of ghost. What if this is forever? What if this is my entire future and I can never get out of it and I never get better? How can I contemplate a future like this?
But then Anna would hear Pete's key in the front door. She'd hear him put his stuff down and shuffle up the stairs to her room.
I just think, oh, I've survived another day on my own. He's back. And my heart would lift, it really would. There was something that happened when we were in the dark together that kind of somehow lit up the darkness. I just couldn't listen to music. But if he was in the dark with me, we could listen to music. And we listened to a Beethoven piano concerto. And the last movement is really, really joyful and bouncy. And we both sat on the bed in my room in the dark. And we were kind of bouncing around and boffing to this music. He said to me, we couldn't do this if we were in the concert hall, which is very true, actually.
Pete was Anna's fiancé. He proposed to her during a stroll they'd taken through an ancient forest, months before she'd ended up in the dark. Back when Anna was only slightly sensitive to light. Back when they both believed she'd get better in no time. But now...
I was kind of wrecking his life alongside mine. And I was really, really worried that I was doing something totally unethical and totally immoral. I need to leave him. And I think, I can't leave him. I just can't do it. I love him. I just can't do it.
One day, Pete came home and told Anna he had to go away in a month for work.
God, do you have to go away again? You know, what's going to happen to me? It's just terrible. I can't cope. He just got quite cold and said, well, I do have to go. You know, this is my work. This is important. Oh, why does it always have to be you? Can't they get somebody else? You know, you've got caring responsibilities. And then he said, well, I have to have my holiday. You know that. If I didn't have my holiday, I can't really... Well, he actually said, I'd probably beat you up. But he didn't mean that. And I think at that point, I realised this is such a strain on you as well. It was so easy for me to forget that and think that I was the person doing all the suffering. As the time in the black went on, and I didn't seem to be getting better, he said to me, we're going to have to cancel this wedding, aren't we? And I went, what wedding?
Anna had been in the black so long that the outside world with all of its demands was fading away. She was simply trying to figure out what she could do to get better and be back among the living.
I was very broad-minded. I did not rule out anything.
She tried hypnotherapy. She tried acupuncture. She tried this thing called meditation visualization. She tried Reiki healing.
None of them worked.
I mean, were you ever confronted with the question, like, are you sure this isn't psychological, what you're experiencing? Maybe there was something that was in your head.
Well, it's really interesting because, as with all my experiments, I kept detailed notes of what worked. And I conclude, absolutely, that the things that made a difference to my condition were always physical interventions.
One day, Pete told her that he'd read about beta carotene, that it can help her skin build resilience to light. Anna phoned up her doctor, who said sure, there shouldn't be too many side effects. So Anna started taking large doses of beta carotene, up to 20 pills a day.
You know, I could feel as soon as I started taking it, the burning was slightly subsiding. It was just like somebody turning down the thermostat a little bit.
And after a few days, Anna found herself downstairs in the kitchen, quickly preparing her morning tea.
The normal beginnings of the build-up to the burning just wasn't happening. I was absolutely amazed when I realised this. And then I thought, I can stay down here a bit longer. And then I thought, what do I do? What should I do with this amazing kind of, this amazing period of grace that I didn't know why it happened or if it had happened again or what it was going to lead to.
Anna strutted into the living room and started moving the furniture against the wall.
And I just started walking up and down the lounge, experiencing the feeling of kind of swinging my legs and striding out, which I hadn't done for so long. And then I started to feel the tingling again. So I thought, okay, I went back into my lair. And I tried to forget about it. I thought, don't get too hopeful. Don't even let yourself start to think that could be the beginning of something, because if it isn't, you'll be just devastated. The next day it happened again. I was able to go downstairs and stay there for a little while and just kind of potter about in the gloom before the beginnings of the burning kicked in again. And it went on like that for a bit until I then decided to risk the next step, which was to get one of our long velvet curtains and just draw it back a little bit and let in a sort of small shaft of daylight. So I was sort of humming and hawing about the next step, and Pete said, what you need is a photographic light meter.
With this tool, Anna could measure the amount of light she was being exposed to the further she stepped outside of her black room. And in turn, she could keep track of how much she could tolerate and for how long. This idea was kind of brilliant. It was like the enchanted princess had been given a key to navigate in the light.
So I became an absolute photographic light meter bore, because I'd say, oh, you know, I can do f2.8 at 1 second, which is, it's the sun's below the horizon, but you can still see colour in the world. Lots of pinks and reds and golds. I'd try f4, which was a little bit more colour. f5.6 is when the sun's only just gone beyond below the horizon. At f8, actually, I was kind of wandering around through the houses, and I went round the back into this little valley, which was open at either end. I turned onto a path, looked down it, and suddenly there was the sun in the sky, this great big red low sun. Oh yeah, it was the most incredible and strange and fairly weird encounter. It was like looking at the thing that had caused all my problems, but the thing that I also had to learn how to live with again. I stood there looking at it for a while, and I said, hello, sun.
Anna started teaching piano lessons from home. She was cooking dinner again. She and Pete were enjoying walks together at dusk. And so one day, Pete turned to her and said, let's have another go at this wedding.
I had to get a wedding jacket made that matched my dress, and I also got an enormous wedding hat made. This huge, large brimmed hat with a huge silk flower on it. I mean, I sort of worked on the principle that if you end up having to wear a hat to your own wedding, you might as well make it a really good, spectacular hat.
And then one day in the fall, just weeks before the wedding, Anna was sucked back into the dark.
I was lying in my black room and I was feeling like people were pulling claws or nails over my body like cheese graters. I was just in absolute agony. How can I have done this? How can I have been caught out by the lights? How could I have ended up in such a bad state again? How could I have misunderstood my vulnerabilities and not calculated properly? I absolutely berated myself while sitting in the dark. All the time, this sort of wedding was coming down the track towards me, and I was thinking, I don't know if I can do this. And obviously the thought was going through both of our minds, well, are we going to have to cancel this for a second time? I remember we were standing in the living room. I didn't think he was listening to me. I grabbed both his arms and kind of made him stand in front of me and look at me and said to him, look, you've got to understand this. If we go ahead with this wedding and my condition doesn't improve, I will understand if you decide to divorce me. And he sort of said, well, okay, but let's hope it doesn't get to that. It was pretty gut-wrenching.
Anna committed herself to the black until the day of the wedding. And even then, she still wasn't sure if she'd make it to the church.
Pete was kind of charging around downstairs, sorting out the final details. People came to put up the marquee and the flower lady came and put up all the flowers. And I could hear all this going on underneath as I was kind of sitting upstairs. Pete would come up to me periodically and kind of tell me what was going on and show me little pictures on the back of his camera, how it was all shaping up and how the decorations were looking, etc., etc. And then I thought, well, I'd better get dressed then. So I put on my wedding dress in the dark, went into the bathroom. The bathroom was very dim, so I couldn't really see what I was doing. I kind of brushed my hair in an approximate way. I put my face really close to the mirror and peered at myself and kind of slathered some makeup on. Not too much, because I just would have looked stupid, but I put a little bit of stuff on my eyes and my lips and hoped it was in the right place. And then Pete said, right, it's time to go.
At the front door, Anna held on to her large brimmed hat and made a dash for the car. When she and Pete arrived at the church, she could almost hear a collective sigh of relief from their friends and family in the congregation. Although she could barely make out their faces, the only lighting in the church came from small white candles lining the perimeter, while two massive ones flanked the altar, giving the whole ceremony a certain feel.
The word would be gothic, actually. It probably looked pretty sinister and kind of suitable for some kind of horror movie. The service started and we actually said our vows. Oh my goodness, I'm actually saying these words, and I'm, you know, if I carry on for another 5 minutes, I'll be married. The realisation suddenly came to me that we'd actually made it. So I kind of reeled on my heels. I nearly fell over. I nearly fainted. Pete had to kind of catch me and put me upright again.
The reception took place back at their home, But Anna had to keep escaping to her dark room.
But I sort of grab a few people and take them with me. We sat around in the dark and we were all scoffing wedding cake and kind of chatting.
And when the guests left, Anna was stuck in the dark. It would take months for her to claw her way back out again.
Pete and I, we got back a little shadow of it, a sort of tiny fraction of the life we'd had before, just enough to keep us going. This is the first summer I've actually seen up close for 10 years. Smelling the smell of summer gardens and seeing the bright colours, you know, really, really blue sky and really green trees.
Big thanks to Anna Lindsay for sharing her story. We'll have a link to Anna's memoir, Girl in the Dark, on our website, snapjudgment.org. The sound design for that story was by Leon Morimoto. It was produced by Nancy Lopez. Snap Judgment returns, the most surprising hobo of all time, and Beyonce, like you've never, ever, never seen her before. When Snap Judgment, the end of the rainbow episode, continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the end of the rainbow episode. Today, we're looking at what happens when you get at least a version of what you want. And for the next story, our hero, he had some very simple demands. Snap Judgment.
So this story is brought to us by a person with a very cool job.
Yeah.
Her name is Nancy Pope.
Hi there.
And she is a curator at the Smithsonian.
Actually, at the National Postal Museum. Because, you know, history, truth, you gotta kind of do that.
But back in 1984, when she first got to the Smithsonian, Nancy was given a really boring newbie task, organizing old photos in the archives.
And some of these photos I started looking, it's like it's a dog. You know, it's a dog laying down on mailbags. It's a dog sitting on mailbags. It's a dog. And I started going, what is the thing with the dang dog?
That's when one of her coworkers told her to go down to the third floor and see for herself.
And I went down and they had all the stamps and a little post office and some mailboxes and a dead stuffed dog. Oni.
Oni. That was the dog's name. The one she saw in the photographs. And now here he was, in the flesh. Kinda.
The hair was mangy, the eyes were smoky, and he did not look like, you know, a cute little dog. He just looked like some little, you know, creepy monster.
The dog had actually been in that case since 1911.
And at one point, we lifted the case up maybe an inch, and this stench came flying out. We almost dropped the case and broke it right then and there. It was the smell of almost a century of dead dog, and it was the most horrible smell that I have ever smelled in my entire life.
Okay, so not a great first impression, but here's the thing. Once upon a time,
he had been the world's most famous canine, the only dog to travel around the world. And there was widespread mourning when he died.
Nancy says that Oni's story begins in Albany, New York, way back in the winter of 1888, when a puppy belonging to one of the clerks at the local post office followed him to work one day. The puppy, Oni, was just a scruffy little mutt then, nothing special. But when the clerk left, Oni stayed.
Because the pup loved the smell of mailbags. and the dog would head straight for a pile of empty mail bags that are off in the corner and just kind of snuggle up, wiggle around in them, and go to sleep for the night.
Oni loved the smell of mail bags so much that he would actually follow them onto the mail wagons that were bound for the train yard. If a bag ever fell off, he'd jump off with it and guard the bag until a postal clerk, and only a postal clerk, came by to pick it up.
Maybe he recognized the uniform? I honestly don't know.
Until one day, Oni took his love of mail bags a step further. When the wagon he was on arrived at the rail yard, he actually followed the bags onto one of the trains.
And the clerks could have just thrown him off at that point, but they didn't. So, you know, he just went to Boston.
Nancy says that back then, a train's mail car was a place of almost constant activity. You have to imagine postal employees frantically sorting an endless variety of packages, dodging kerosene lamps, trying to get everything ready for delivery before each and every stop. But in the midst of the chaos, there was a little corner where discarded mail bags lay in a pile. That's where Oni sat on this first trip, comfortable, just watching them do their work.
And when the train opened up its doors in Boston, Oni jumped out and traveled with the mail bags on the wagon to the Boston post office. Sat around there a little bit, and the next day, he went on the train and went back to Albany.
Thus was established a pattern whereby Oni became a regular on these regional rail lines. Nothing too ambitious, just day trips.
But the railway postal clerks were family. And when a clerk got to the end of his line, he would start talking about this dog.
As Oni's reputation grew among the postal employees, so did his network of available trains. It's like he had the 19th century version of a Europass, only with mail cars.
And then he started branching out through Cleveland, Philadelphia, and then Washington, D.C. He loved Brooklyn.
But of course, that was just the Northeast. He also went south.
To Mobile, Alabama, Jackson, Florida, Atlanta.
And to the Midwest.
Fort Wayne, Indiana, Wichita, Grand Rapids, in Minneapolis, Kansas City, St. Louis, Butte.
And everywhere else.
Albuquerque, Reno.
Oh my God.
Cincinnati, Denver.
Now I'm going to stop you.
Yeah, you know, it was, you name a state, he was there.
By 1889, there were reports of Oni in California.
So we know that within a year, he's crossed the country.
This is the part where I hate to poke a hole in it, and maybe I shouldn't.
Oh, poke a hole.
How much independence does this dog have in these decisions to be branching out? Is he, like, at the train station, and he sees a train car, and he's like, that one looks good, and, like, decides all on his own?
Well, there was a lot to be said for that. Oni really did just jump on any old train he wanted and go wherever he wanted to go.
When Oni got to a town, he always followed the same routine. He would get out of the train, take the mail wagon to the post office, and then spend the night, usually at the local postmaster's house, who always made sure that there were some mail bags for Oni to sleep on.
And before long, newspapers across the country, if Oni was in town, then the publisher said, you gotta go out and do a story on the dog.
Oni proved so popular that eventually it wasn't enough that he simply come to town. People wanted to prove that he'd been there. So they started putting these customized tags on his collar. Sometimes it was an official tag with the name of the town. Other times someone would hastily scratch their name on a hotel key and loop that through his collar. Lots of people gave him these little metal coupons.
And, you know, if Oni had wanted to, he could have gotten 5 cents off for a loaf of bread at one spot, free drinks at the bar at a couple of others. He could have had a great night on the town if he was a person.
Elaborate feasts were routinely held in Oni's honor. So rich and filling were the meals that the day after one such dinner in Providence, Rhode Island, Oni took one look at a free steak and walked away.
And he just puts his nose up at it like, you know, I'm still full. I can't handle a steak.
Oni had all the benefits of fame and none of the costs. He was a dog. He didn't know he was famous. He didn't feel any of the pressure, didn't worry about all the attention. He was free to just be, at least for the first few years.
But then it gets to the point where, as Oni got more and more famous, the clerks start actually putting him on a train. Like, Oni needs to go on this train, wouldn't that be fun?
Slowly but surely, the freewheeling hobo of everyone's imagination was no longer quite so freewheeling. Increasingly, in the very same articles that extolled Oni's freedom, you could read all about the cities where he could be found next. It was freedom scripted.
But the height of Oni being handled by clerks was obviously the trip around the world.
The trip was a marketing stunt put on by the city of Tacoma. They were trying to one-up their more famous neighbor, Seattle. So, with the consent of the post office, they sent Oni packing on a mail ship to East Asia,
where he got a passport from the Emperor of Japan,
then on to China and India,
through the Suez Canal,
and then via the Azores back to America.
He made it in 118 days.
By this point, Oni was so famous that European newspapers issued heated editorials wondering why Oni had skipped their continent entirely. It seemed like everyone wanted a piece of him.
And when he would go to each of these foreign lands, he was trotted out. And Oni, you know, who knows whether he was happy or not. But as the clerks started kind of ruling his life, people added more and more tags to his collar. Businesses love to put something on him because it's free advertising for your business, which is fine, except, you know, you think the collar around the dog's neck, you add 10 tags, one thing, you start adding 20, 30 tags, the poor dog's not going to be able to lift his head up.
Every time Oni returned to Albany, the clerks made sure to take the tags off. Eventually, they had to give him a harness to accommodate all the extra weight, but even that was rarely enough.
The Smithsonian has 347 tags. It has been said in a lot of reports that he had over 1,000, which is easy for me to believe. But I really think that Oni needed to stop riding the trains. Clerks were saying that he didn't look good. He didn't look well.
Oni was growing increasingly irritable, especially when people tried to touch the tags on his harness, either to add or remove them. He also started fighting back when clerks tried to force him onto a particular train. He was just getting stubborn and old.
So a clerk in St. Louis took him in. And I think in his time in the clerk's backyard, he started to relax and be his old dog self. And we know that Oni had enough free will that if he didn't want to stay there, he wouldn't have. But there were some clerks that just didn't want to hear that. You know, Oni, to them, Oni belonged on the train cars.
So the clerks borrowed Oni for one last joyride. They put him on a train bound for Toledo. And at first, everything was the same as it always had been. Oni followed the familiar scent of the mailbags off the train and onto the wagon. But when he arrived at the Toledo post office, one of the clerks taking him to meet a local reporter tried to touch one of his tags.
And that's what set him off. And he bites the clerk in the hand very hard twice.
The clerk reeled off in pain. And when the postmaster came in to see what was going on, Oni attacked him too.
And the postmaster calls a U.S. Marshal named Shannon. Shannon comes into the room, takes out his pistol, and shoots Oni once in the head.
Oni was killed instantly. When the news got out, obituaries around the country mourned his passing, and his body was taken to Washington, D.C., at the post office's national headquarters. But over the years, as Oni went in and out of storage, he was forgotten. By the time Nancy stumbled upon him, the world's most famous canine had become a footnote. But thanks in part to her efforts, Oni is back in the spotlight, and in 2011, he got his own stamp. He also has his very own exhibit at the Smithsonian's Postal Museum. Nancy says it's one of the most popular exhibits there.
But we have a good number of people who will say in a blog or in a review or whatever, you know, it's a great museum, but it's got this disgusting stuffed dog.
Thank you so much to Nancy Pope for sharing Oni's story with us. And if you want to learn more, you can visit Oni in person and see some of those tags at the Smithsonian's National Postal Museum in Washington, D.C. We're going to have a link on our website to an interactive map of the museum put up showing all the places that we know Oni visited. It's, is what it is. Check it out at snapjudgment.org. The sound design for that story was by Leon Morimoto. It was produced by Joe Rosenberg. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the end of the rainbow episode. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Amongst the 2016 election craziness, the stump speeches, the tweets, what is really going on? What does it take to win the most powerful job in the world? You can't understand today's candidates without listening to yesterday's. What do you know about Shirley Chisholm, the black woman who ran for president in 1972 and paved the way for both Obama and Hillary? Seriously, she is the boss. Do you know what Howard Dean thinks went wrong with his campaign? Or how George Bush beat John McCain in the primaries? Learn about the strategic choices and human moments that determine who wins and who loses. This blood sport we call presidential elections. The Contenders. 16 for 16 is a new series from my favorite, stay interesting source, Ozzy, airing on PBS starting Tuesday, September 13th at 8 p.m. 9 Central and every consecutive Tuesday leading up to the election. Learn more at Ozzy, OZY.com. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the end of the rainbow episode. My name is Lynn Washington, and today we're looking at people lucky enough to get a version of their fondest desires. And our next piece walks the gossamer thread between truth and imagination, a brand new radio play inspired by author Kelly Link. Snap Judgment. Hello?
Hey, why would anyone need three jars of maraschino cherries?
What you doing?
Clearing out the fridge.
We've been through this. Your roommate is crazy. Find another place.
Some of us can't afford our own places.
Then some of us better not complain.
Ugh, you are so annoying.
You call me!
So, what's your point?
Well, now that I have you, I started writing a story.
Oh, yeah? You know, I just finished another chapter. I'm sending it to my agent later today.
Okay, cool. So, I got this idea last night. I was on the BART, about to go back across the bay, and I look across the car, and there's this woman. She's super hot. She's got this hair, blonde hair. She looks at me, smiles, and winks at me. And she looks just like Beyonce.
I don't think Beyonce is getting off at West Oakland.
Well, think again. Because she gets off at my station. And now I'm walking with her. She stops in front of my building.
She must have thought you were super creepy.
I'm a creep for going home.
I mean, didn't she think you were following her? She didn't freak out?
No. We get to the building. Go up the stairs. And understand this. She lives on my floor.
How convenient.
Hush. I'm telling you, we stop in front of her door, which is right across the hallway from my door.
So there's a point to this story.
And she winks goodnight to me, and then she flickers. Like she's, made out of a hologram.
Like Beam Me Up Scotty?
Like Help Me Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like she's a projection. She's flickering, and then she turns solid again like a real person. And then she unlocks her door and leaves me in the hallway.
So you didn't get invited inside?
I could have, if I wanted to. It was just weird. I don't know.
I've been in love with Jack for what feels like forever. I met him at one of his readings. I brought his first book, dog-eared and taped together. I waited in line for him to sign it, and when I held it out, he smiled at me. laughed a little. He said, "No one reads this book." And then he asked me out for a drink. Here's the thing about Jack. He doesn't really have the looks, but he's commanding. He took me for cocktails and told me about a woman he was sending anonymous love letters to. I felt invisible. Jack became my mentor, slashing my stories apart, writing mean, flirty comments in the margins. I wanted him bad. Still do, I guess. But he slowed down, and his agent has warned him that if he doesn't write another book in the next year, he's dropping them. And the thing is, I'm speeding up. I've got an agent now too, a friend of Jack's, and I've got a novel. But I still call Jack daily, like a reflex.
Hello?
I didn't need that check.
I know. I was worried. With the roommate.
I ripped it up.
A thank you would have been nice.
You know, you never give me any credit. You know I just got my advance, right? I'm actually okay, if you can believe it. I'm good. Yeah. So you see your new neighbor Beyonce recently?
Yeah. Actually, I was going to say she knocked on my door yesterday and asked to borrow a cup of sugar.
That's original.
Didn't recognize me, though, so I didn't bring the other night up.
So you gave her the sugar.
But when I go to shut the door, I watch her through the peephole.
Gross.
No. Look here. She ate all the sugar. I watched her down the whole cup.
What?
I know. Get this. Then she knocks on my door again. When I open it, she just walks in, pours herself a drink. My best whiskey. And we drank like half the bottle. And then just start making out. Going for it. Amazing. I mean, she's amazing. She smelled like fresh laundry. And she tasted like cherries. And I go to, you know, and it's smooth down there.
Oh, no. It's called the Brazilian.
No. It was like Barbie smooth. There was nothing going on, you know, down there.
TMI, man. TMI. I don't think you're doing it right.
I look at the Beyonce lady, and she just gets up and walks out.
Smart woman.
Kyle, I'm telling the truth.
Okay, Jack.
Kelly used to flip when I told her I met someone, been with somebody. She'd be like, "Let's blow everything off and go to Vegas. Let's get married by three Elvises." And I would always change the subject, take her to dinner, in the night with maybe a kiss on the cheek, a little too close to her lips. But I never gave her an in. I would have never before tonight. Because tonight she just didn't seem to care. Now I'm just sitting here at my computer, cursor blinking, ready for words, and all I can think about is whether or not she's jealous. Which is stupid, right? Because of course she's jealous.
Hello?
Jack, I saw them.
Who?
The Beyonce women.
Women? You saw more than one?
Yeah. I was leaving my agent's office, got into the elevator. There were 11 women in there. I counted. 11 Beyoncés. I get in and they stop talking. They're just there, breathing. Like together, perfectly in time. And they smell the same, like detergent.
Yes. That's what she smells like, my neighbor.
Their smell. That smell, it got more and more intense. It made my head hurt. So I closed my eyes just for a second. I thought. Because when I woke up, I was alone. And on the top floor of the building, there was a bunch of construction stuff everywhere, like drills and paint cans. And there was just no one.
Where'd they go?
I have no idea.
Hey, you know it's like 3 in the morning, right?
I'm still working on that sci-fi story.
Jesus, that's it? I thought you were in an accident or something. You woke me up.
I just want to talk.
I gotta go.
Why? Somebody there?
Yeah.
Who?
I met him at the bar. After my reading, a bunch of us went out.
Oh. I'm sorry. I totally forgot.
It's okay. It was a good turnout, actually. Anyway, I gotta go.
Wait. I want to ask you, are you okay?
Why wouldn't I be?
I mean, since them Beyonce fembots.
Oh, that. Yeah, I'm okay.
All right. I'll see you tomorrow. Brunch?
Oh, yeah. Maybe. I'll call you.
Okay, well, call me, all right? Bye.
I wake up the man in my bed and ask him if he's ever slept with a blonde. He asks me if this is one of those jokes, and I say no. The man says to me, "You're kind of a blonde." And I choke out a laugh, because it's true. At first I thought, maybe I was starting to go gray, but the hair is yellow. The color of honey, I mean. I've been finding blonde hairs on my pillow, and there's more and more of it every day. My skin smells so clean. And I'm losing hair where I shouldn't be losing hair. The man in my bed said something stupid like, "I like what you got going on down there." And I rolled my eyes.
Hey, it's Kelly. Leave a message. I'll call you back. Hey, it's Kelly. Leave a message. I'll call you back. Hey, it's Kelly. Leave a message. I'll call you back.
Damn it, Kelly. Answer the door. Kelly, I just need to see you.
Hello.
You're here? Let me in.
Jack?
Yeah. Why'd you text me back? I'm freaking out. After you said you weren't alone that night.
Hey there.
What happened to you?
You want some lemonade?
What happened to your hair? How you drink this? It's way too sweet.
Jack, let's sit down.
Kelly, you're scaring me to death. What happened? Why'd you disappear?
You know, I've been thinking about that sci-fi story you were writing.
Do you mean somebody called the cops? Are you all right?
I really think you should just give up on that one.
What?
You know, you shouldn't write sci-fi. You're a serious writer.
You don't want me to write about fembots.
I don't know what you mean by that. You're so silly.
Kelly, what's going on? What'd they do to you?
Jack. Don't you like my hair?
It's not true, Snappers. It's not. Fembots are not taking over the world. And that's because the piece was 100% fiction from the mind of Kelly Link. Adapted, directed, and produced by Mark Ristich and Eliza Smith. Original score and sound design by Pat Mesiti Miller. Voice actors were Joyce Lee and yours truly. Find all things Kelly Link on our website, snapjudgment.org. You've listened to another episode of Snap Judgment. Tell somebody, let your lover know. There are more full episodes right there for the asking. Amazing storytelling for you. Get the podcast. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, or head on over to snapjudgment.org. Hit us on the Facebook or the Twitter. Snappers, listen close. Hear this. Hear this. Snap Judgment Live is on tour with a brand new show. And we're featuring some of your favorite storytellers, including Jamie DeWolf, Don Reed, Jen Kolber, and The Closer, James Judd. Much more. Portland, Seattle, Detroit, Minneapolis, San Francisco, with more cities being added. And every single show is sold out. So get tickets now at snapjudgment.org while you can. Snap was produced by the team that never goes outside long enough to see a rainbow. Think of them in the dark of night. The Uber producer, Mark Ristich. The Pat Man, the C.D. Miller. Anna just had a baby Sussman. Hey, Naomi. Nancy to the Lopez. Eliza's last name is still Smith. Davey Kim and M. Joe, Big Word Rosenberg. Renzo Gorio wears trucker caps. Leon Morimoto goes solo. Adiza Egan does not. Tail, hold the mail to cot. Liz Mack can't pack fat on a stack of hats. Jasmine Aguilera has a 270 bowling average. Believe it. And even though this is not the news, who keeps mistaking this for the news? In fact, you could crash your UFO into the Loch Ness Monster with the Yeti in the back seat shouting directions, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.